I'm Rachel, the creative director for Ram Dass's Love Serve Remember Foundation, and I'd like to welcome you to our Inner Academy, a virtual Dharma hall where our family of wisdom teachers will help you navigate your daily life by bringing ancient wisdom into a modern context. With over 200 hours of audio and video teachings, meditations, and practices from teachers like Ram Dass, Krishna Dass, Sharon Salzberg, Jack Kornfield, Roshi Joan Halifax, Joseph Goldstein, and many more, the Inner Academy is your core resource for finding balance, presence, and navigating the ups and downs of your daily life. The Inner Academy has guidance for every step of your journey. Choose from an annual or monthly membership and gain access to past and future courses, retreat replays, virtual community, and much more. If you've been familiar with Love Serve Remember Foundation for a while, you'll know that most of our offerings are given freely or on a sliding scale basis. So when you subscribe to the Inner Academy, you're paying it forward and bolstering our ability to continue creating accessible offerings for all in the future, as Ram Dass wished for us to do. Be here now and start your journey with Ram Dass's Inner Academy today. For more, visit ramdass.org/innerAcademy.
Teaching meditation can be a deeply rewarding experience. Help others improve their mental and emotional well-being, reduce stress, improve focus, increase self-awareness and self-regulation, all while deepening your own practice and understanding. Join acclaimed author, Buddhist teacher, and Emmy Award-winning musician David Nickturn on Tuesday, May 28th at 6 p.m. Eastern Time for a free online discussion on teaching meditation in Dharma Moon's renowned mindfulness meditation teacher training program. Get certified by Dharma Moon to teach meditation, lead group practice sessions, and work with individual students. Visit dharmamoon.com/be-here-now for more info and to reserve your spot for the free online event with David Nickturn on May 28th.
Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app today to get free delivery on your first three orders, while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
I think we have to look towards spirituality and religion for the answers to try to mediate unbridled materialism, which we know is a death trap.
Hey everyone, it's Mind Rolling Raghu, and I'm back with two of the classiest friends that I have, David Silver and Danny Goldberg. And we've done stuff forever together. And no, I appreciate you guys. And I said when the thing opened up on our Zoom, to see the three of us together, we did stuff that, you know, Danny, of course, you know Danny Goldberg, and he had a podcast on the network in the earlier days. And has been deeply involved in the music business to this day. And basically, David and I kind of played with him at one point. We had some great times when Danny was running some of these labels, and we joined forces a couple of times, Triloka Records at that time. Anyhow, welcome, both of you, Danny, David.
Nice to be here.
Or as
yes, it is. It is nice.
Good. Or as Keith Richards said, "Nice to be anywhere."
Yes.
I think Milton Berle actually was the first one to say that.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, so Keith stole it from Milton.
Yeah.
Unbelievable. Yeah. I want to start with something that it'll be a jumping off point. I was telling this to David, but I did a podcast the other day with a man named Andy Carr, who was a student of Trungpa Rinpoche's for all the way back then, and wrote this really lovely book. And in this book, and he quotes many of his teachers and so on, including Trungpa. So I'm going to read this excerpt. It's worth hearing. Why did the groundbreaking Buddhist teacher Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche declare, "This is the darkest hour of the dark ages. It's worth contemplating." The darkest hour of the dark ages. So Andy says, this is an age of extraordinary material progress. In the developed world, most of us enjoy lifespans, comforts, and possessions that are beyond the wildest dreams of even kings and queens of former times, let alone ordinary folk. And yet this immense bounty has its somber side. All these material advances have not been able to bring us genuine freedom or lasting happiness. We spend our lives trying to feed a deeper hunger for security, comfort, entertainment, without ever getting to the source of our discontent. Today, consumerism is rampant. Inequality and oppression are everywhere. The accumulation of knowledge is valued more than the insight needed to use it wisely. Human exploitation of the natural world has been disastrous for many of the beings with whom we share the planet. 1 million species of animals and plants are now threatened with extinction. The immensity of human impact on the environment has created a climate crisis that threatens our entire civilization. Don't get me wrong. Science and technologies are not enemies of our well-being. The intellectual and material achievements of science and technology are worthy of great respect. Many of these, modern medicine to name just one example, have been extremely beneficial. I cannot imagine living in a world without antibiotics, vaccines, or pasteurization. Nevertheless, it is clear that the accumulation of material wealth and knowledge has not led to a corresponding increase in spiritual wealth and social harmony. Trungpa Rinpoche diagnosed the cause of this failure. The river of materialism has burst its banks. The materialistic outlook dominates everywhere, and the mind is intoxicated with worldly concerns. Anyhow, that's our little jumping off point as to where we are in our world, in our culture, in our particular society, which it seems to be, it's just a village. We are not much different than any other societies in terms of this basic premise that he espoused here. Thoughts?
Well, you can't have everything.
Can I quote you on that?
Sure. Well, it does seem to be a dark time for us, but it's relative, isn't it? I mean, it's always relative. And to say it's the darkest of dark times is a statement from Trungpa, who knew a lot more about everything than I do. So I really don't want to dispute that. But of course, life is made up of trillions of moments. And for individuals, some of those moments are incredibly joyous, no matter how dark the context is, either societal or global or political or economic. However, we are living in a time when, particularly in America, idiots are being elected on a regular basis. And that is a sign, I think, of something of what he was talking about. Why? Yeah. Why is the public so attracted to obvious liars and hypocrites and worse? So on that level, I would say we're in a dark time. But, you know, my own personal life is enhanced by pharmacology and by modern surgery and all kinds of stuff. And, I have to think of that balance in a very Buddhist way, ironically. That there is a middle way, and middle ways, well, how one deals with this with this global context.
Mm. Yeah, good view. Danny, what's your take on this?
Well, there is a thing about human beings that seems like the ability to evolve as far as technology and materialism is greater than the evolution of morality and spiritual consciousness. They do seem to operate on different timelines. And, you know, as we, I'm not sure when people will hear this, but we're talking the beginning of July. I know in a week or so, the Oppenheimer movie is coming out. And, you know, the issue of the scientists like him and Einstein who were doing just research into understanding the atomic structure with, I think, considerable idealism, and that became subordinate to military purposes that created, prior to climate change, the greatest threat to humanity with nuclear bombs, you know, is that was also a huge turning point for the human race. I don't know. It's what's interesting to me is, what is the role of spirituality? What is the role of religion in all of this? You know, why aren't religions, which are supposed to be organized around spirituality, and which in some cases are, in some cases become like materialistic power centers their own, more influential in group and social, you know, the decisions and the idea that we're all in this together, as opposed to we're all in competition with each other or with other groups. Why somehow the, you know, thousands of years of Christianity and however long Islam's been going on, and Judaism and Hinduism and all these teachings, that they just haven't somehow translated into social behavior that can, you know, manage this technology in a way that's not self-destructive. I don't know why, but I think we have to look towards spirituality and religion for the answers to try to mediate unbridled materialism, which we know is a death trap, you know, that just totally uninhibited, unbridled materialism would mean you would just go in with guns and steal everything you wanted, you know, and kill people if they got in your way. So, I, whether it's the darkest or what, you know, there's what... When he said that, you know, what year did he say it?
He died in the 80s, so it's got to be, you know.
So, I mean, obviously, one thing I will say, and I, look, obviously, he's smarter than I am. But as a general matter, when people say this is the worst of times, I don't see how you could say that to somebody that was in the concentration camps, you know. Or someone who's a black person who grew up in Mississippi in the 50s, or, you know, a lot of other things. I mean, I think that the central clash between materialism and compassion and spirituality seems to have been present for all of recorded history. And there's a certain narcissism to me about thinking that, gee, this is the worst time. We have uniquely bad things. Nobody from the past could ever deal with anything like this. That irks me. You know, that somehow I think you got to go to a different space to really be part of the so-called solution.
Yeah. Although in terms of this particular time, environmentally, I think that, you know, many people say we're past the tipping point.
Just as we speak, this summer, it's kind of mind-blowing.
Oh, my God.
Some of the temperatures, I know.
And the flooding. It's just a very
Armageddon-ish. It's the human race. Look, who knows what it'll be, you know, when our we all have kids, you know, what the rest of their lives will be like when we're on another plane. I mean, it's unbelievable. The inability of any, it's not just the United States, the other powerful countries in the world have the same disease of short-term materialistic thinking, subordinating the common good, which even includes them. It really makes one question the theory of evolution.
You know, I've been working on, for Love, Serve, Remember, on a course that we're going to be presenting in the fall, which is Alan Watts and Ram Dass together addressing, not together addressing, they didn't do talks together, but addressing, you know, general issue. The overriding thing is really the Dharma of Alan Watts and Ram Dass. And then we have, you know, themes. And the first theme was around the illusion of separateness. Mm. And people putting it together, Alan, all he talked about in very poetic ways was how we grow, we immediately grow into feeling we are a separate unit. We are, everything supports that. All of our habitual patterns and neurotic tendencies, society, school, all of it. It all supports us being this, we got to watch out for ourselves here or else, you know, you're a little kid and you get fear. You get a name and you suddenly go, wait, I am a something different, right? When you're able to recognize that. So they said to me, it seems like that's all Alan talked about. And I said, that's probably why so many people were attracted to him, where he was really expressing the true reality of why are we not recognizing our interconnectedness with everything, everyone, and our environment, the animals, all of it. And I just found that such a potent thing from him, you know, that is so relevant today. And I think that's what we're talking about.
So you say they knew each other, right? You say they didn't do talks together, but they were friends, weren't they?
They were friends. They were drinking buddies and occasional psychedelic buddies. And we do have stuff from Ram Dass telling stories and so on about Alan.
But there's no like recordings of the two of them having a conversation
No. So this will be the first time really in that, you know, you'll be able to hear their point of view, which is so very different. I mean,
right.
Alan, of course, Gyan Yoga and non-duality is coming from, and Ram Dass coming from the heart, but not just
devotion.
The heart, because Ram Dass also delved into all of these other traditions, which we just talked about.
Right. Yeah. No, that was one of the great gifts Ram Dass gave was openness to Jesus, to Buddhism, to that it was ecumenical. The truth was not confined to any one tradition. That was a good one.
Well, that didn't come from him. That came from Nim Karoli Baba, who, you know what I'm saying, it's just...
Well, but for us mere civilians who weren't in India,
Ram Dass,
the radio was where we got it. No, obviously, Ramakrishna, same thing. Ramakrishna talked about, all different paths, you know, and there were all the great teachers, I think, did, but for... You know, the rock and roll audience, Ram Dass was the one of the messengers.
Absolutely. Okay, so David, are you? I'm assuming.
My life, yes.
Yeah, no.
I was going to say I had a 2-hour conversation with Alan Watts myself.
And, shit. Can you talk about that? I got to interview you on that for the course, for Christ's sake.
It was in 1969, and Lowell George, who some of you out there will know who that is, gave me Alan's number. He had it. Lowell had Alan's number and Aldous Huxley's number.
Lowell was the member of the band Little Feet, great, great, influential musician,
Yes, and he stayed in my house many times, and I was very close to him, actually.
Yeah.
But he at one point he said, I know both those guys. So he gave me Alamo's number. I called him and Alan answered the phone.
No.
And we had a long conversation. I was 26 years old and, you know, babe in arms in terms of spiritual stuff. Nice dog there, by the way.
Thank you. That's Maya. Yeah. She's my podcast co-host.
You know, I love dogs. So, you know, well, I remember it. I mean, the reason I brought it up was not just a name drop, but because he was extraordinarily warm to me. I mean, he asked the phone, hello. I said, hello, is this Alan Walsh? Yes, it is. Who is this? David Silver. He'd never obviously heard of me or cared. And for the next 90 minutes or 2 hours, I don't remember, he could not have been more wonderful. I mean, in a way that most people, luminaries, would not be on the phone with a cold call from some English guy. I think the fact that I had an English accent of a much greater weight at that time made some difference. And he realized I was an emigre like him. But he was extremely warm. Did he bring up separateness? No. We talked mainly about why it seems that LSD and mescaline and so on gave us, while taking the ground from under our feet, gave us a much deeper, quick awareness of the divine and why, in his opinion. And his opinion was that it's a neurological, you know, maze up there. And these substances gave us the ability to see that the separateness, if not that he used that word, but that the general objectivization of all things outside our little head here as something else was rubbish. Mm. And he was firm about that. And so was Ramdas. And, you know, the hard thing about that is the transformation of thinking or of intuition from that this laptop here, this steel Apple thing made in China, is actually not separate from me. And that, you know, Melania Trump is not separate from me are hard. Hard roads to travel, nevertheless. So my own attempt at this is through meditation. That's the only way. I mean, and learning from other people who, as Danny said, you know more than we do, probably. And so, you know, when I hear anything from Ramakrishna or Yogananda or Nim Karoli or Simbari, any of these great sadhus and saints, tend to believe them. That's my ground for it. It's not observational. It's not empirical, because my empirical organ tells me that there is, in fact, separateness. So, you know, what to do? Steady, I guess.
Practice, practice, practice.
I know.
But, you know, taking another objective view on it, I mean, I guess the environment is such a deep core cause of just upset with so many people and people who are living in villages in the Punjab right now, you know, dealing with it directly in Vermont in the heat and so it's a very direct, you know, suffering in relation to the evolvement of this planet and what we're doing. At the same time, it's where do you hitch your horse in terms of deciding to, wow, this is something that I need to attend to in my own life. It's not, and I don't mean just separating the plastic and, you know, in terms of the garbage. It's like, and I go back to this issue. That's why I love that conversation that you had with Alan was very much of what I've been hearing as they've been developing these talks for me to, you know, just take a listen to around the ridiculousness that we are not interconnected, that we walk around thinking we are not connected. And, you know, for that, I mean, he was just extraordinary. But then, so it's the will to take a step, and that doesn't mean it's not social action of some sort related to any one of these subjects, but it's about that inner social action, which Ram Dass used to say, that's what we are doing, in terms of this Love, Serve, Remember Foundation, that's what we are doing. We are allowing people to work on themselves so they can change, and that change will reflect in the hearts of everyone they meet, which seems like a simplistic thing, but it's so real and so, in my mind, very much needed as an example that, yes, no, we are absolutely connected. So, yeah, I think, David, when you talk about meditation as a possibility, a chant, whatever it is that you do to get to the place where we are not separate, we are connected. And, you know, I like to think mindfulness of just walking around and understanding our self-interested motivations is another big step, no?
Yes.
I think that's all undeniable. I think it would also help if we expanded the Supreme Court. because it is a weird, talking about trying to function on different levels.
Yeah.
And I totally am down with the idea of not demonizing people who one disagrees with, especially since, you know, I had strong opinions 20 years ago that I don't even necessarily agree with. But, you know, there is a weird thing in the United States to the extent, you know, I think probably a lot of people who listen to this are in the United States that, you know, we don't really have the majority rule. You know, we have structures that were created in the 18th century with the purpose of having a minority rule the majority. And the interests, you know, these all are real things. And, you know, I was just in Athens, and, you know, I'm so awestruck by always the ruins there, of the Acropolis, and remembering Pericles kind of was the vehicle through which the West, as we know it, whatever's good about the West, traditions of education, democracy, and other things kind of started. And, you know, I think democracy is still probably the best chance of getting, you know, sane, non-self-destructive social behavior and encouraging anything. And it's scary because sometimes most people, like, you know, disagree with what I believe in, you know, and then if you believe in democracy, you have to live with that. But right now there's this weird disconnect between majority opinion on a lot of things, including the importance of regulating industry and the economics in the service of reducing the climate catastrophe. And, you know, it's a real thing, you know, to try to get them. And I think all over the world, you know, you've got minorities of people who have some narrow materialistic interest at the expense of everybody else. So I don't know. Democracy is not quite at the level of the greatest cosmic philosophies that you properly focus on here. But it's not nothing. In terms of if you're trying to also deal with material pain and deteriorating things, you know. So somehow the challenge to me is to keep honoring, loving everybody and understanding that the human mind doesn't know what the cosmic truth is, and to try to listen and also to be ethically vigilant about doing what one can do in every sphere, which includes expanding the Supreme Court, which I think is the only pathway possible to avoid complete catastrophe.
Yeah. You said this to me when before the Trump election. Okay. It's not a matter of Trump getting elected and being whatever he is or he isn't. It's a matter of he will put people on the Supreme Court that will change the trajectory of this country. You were right, of course. It's not a
well. I was just echoing what other people were saying.
Yeah, no.
You know, but it's I remember someone whose name shall not be mentioned saying, "I thought the only problem with Trump was his comb over." which I thought in your home at that time, a person we won't mention.
Okay, and I don't remember who it was.
That was not really actually the essence of the issue. But God, look, I know that the anger, that what he's appealing to is a sense of people feeling invisible, ignored.
Yeah, and separated big time.
And separated, you know, yeah. And it's a thing. But, you know, at some point, you can love everybody and still believe that majority interests and opinions should prevail. You know, that those two things I don't think are inconsistent, although
no.
I'm not quite wise enough to formulate a philosophical thing about it.
Absolutely. Well, it's like, as humans, this is another Ram Dassism, we can all live on more than one plane of consciousness at the same time. The human level, the gyan, the intellectual understanding level, you know, the level of which we do see that interconnectivity and we are acting from that place. But we can't act from that place all the time. And so it's a mix-up, mash-up.
No, it's just listening to it. Listen, every morning when I wake up, I don't want to get out of bed, without exception. I do not want to get out of bed. I can't imagine finding the energy to do anything. Mm. I'm in a complete funk. And then at some point, some other part of myself says, go and take a shower right now. And I do it, and then okay, now what do I have to do? So, what's interesting to me is that you know that I'm so this is on a different subject, but like the unconscious can be your enemy, but it can also be your friend, depending on what part of the unconscious is. And I'm so grateful for whatever that is inside me that actually gets me out of bed, because this thing that's talking now,
yeah,
has no interest in it. I mean, 100% of the time.
That's so great. I love the way you put that. You know, Sharon Salzberg, she has a name for that thing that is going on. She's called, yeah. I don't know, you know, Lois. Okay,
no, you're
Lois.
Right, right.
Shut up for a minute. I got to hear this other voice, okay?
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, God, that's so great. Dave?
Yeah.
You have a couple, anyhow.
I was just thinking about Pericles, because as far as I know, he was half a millennium BC, okay? 450 BC.
So absolutely. Yeah.
So that's a matter of 2,500 years ago, 2.5 millennia. He assembled approximately 500 people on a hillside, and they voted for themselves.
No, 6,000.
Really?
It had to be... which it's unbelievable to me with the population of that time, according to the tourist information at the sites in Athens, that for major decisions required 6,000 and the giant thing, which means that almost everybody in the surrounding areas was involved, because I mean the population was only what 1/50th of what it is now or something.
Yeah.
But.
Yeah. 6,000 is a lot. It's not bad. No slaves, no women. I mean, there was something between slaves and freed men and women. I've forgotten the name of it, that also existed in Pericles' time, which he initiated, I believe. So here was a guy who saw all this. He was a general. He was a military, really, but a marvelous orator and somebody who really thought that democracy was an idea that would persist and would help people. And I think you said before, Danny, that anything... that gives what the Rastas call sufferers a break, what Biden calls a shot. Anybody that attempts that is doing the work of God, really, because that's why I've never been able to get with massively elitist political people and visions. You know, like in England, it was the Tory Party. And actually, Michelle Goldberg, who I really like, wrote an article in this morning's Time about Tory sleaze.
Yeah, did you? I read that today. Did you like that piece?
Very much.
Oh,
I found it to be. Oh God, did it? Because first of all, the only thing I disagree with Michelle about is it's been going on forever. It's not a new thing. The Conservative Party, you know, even during Churchill in the early 50s, was known to only be protecting a very small part of the British population. which emanated from royalty to nobility to rich people.
Right.
And, you know, what she says in the thing is that it wasn't just Boris Johnson that was bad. It was a history of real separation, not anxiety, the opposite, separation love between the elite that ran India and many parts of the world from this little tiny nothing country in the middle of the Atlantic. And, you know, that's what the Tory party was. And now it's denigrated, it's disintegrated into a kind of sleazy group of people who are just taking as much money as they can and throwing parties when everyone else is dying of COVID. Bad stuff. And Michelle says, I'm talking about her as if I know her. I don't know her at all. But she's
and
very
she's
smart.
No relation. I don't know her either, even though her name is Goldberg.
I guess there are a few Goldbergs around.
Quite a common name. Yeah.
Yes, including Whoopi. But I mean, what she's saying is that there's an endemic, a systemic problem in that two-party system in England, in Britain, because one represents a tiny part of the population that still has the power. And the same is not that different here. I mean, what McCain got Feingold, to my mind, were trying to do, get rid of that whole thing of massive donations from massively rich influencers, didn't happen.
Well, so what happened, just factually, McCain-Feingold was incremental progress in lowering the influence of money in politics, which was then eliminated by the Supreme Court in the Citizens United decision, current Chief Justice, I think, wrote that opinion. And Obama said it at the time, and you remember, I don't know if you remember at the State of the Union, Obama saying it in Alito, on the floor of the State of the Union, shaking his head in disgust. And so again, the Supreme Court, you've got, and this is so not appropriate for her to be here now, Love, Serve, Remember Network.
So it's all appropriate.
But, you know, 6 of the 9 were appointed by presidents that got less votes than the people they ran against. Hmm. So that's not democratic. It's a system that has to be modernized. It's so funny though, because I look at the British system as being more democratic, because the parliamentary systems to me are inherently can be more democratic. But yet the parallels between the two countries are so incredible. I mean, it's like we're one country, England and the United States, really, in a certain way. Yeah. And then you look all over everywhere else in the world. What's the Indian government like, Raghu, right now? Is it a positive thing for most people, or is it encouraging polarization and demonization of Muslims? I can't figure it out.
No, it's polarization. But then if I talk to my great friend who drives me around when I'm in India, he's actually a devotee of Neem Karoli Baba as well. And he's maybe, you know, late 30s or something, got a family, lives in a small village. And he says, you know, this guy, Modi, actually did a bunch of things that helped poor people in India.
Right, that's what I've heard.
Yeah, and so, you know, is he doing it to enhance the vote for himself? Yeah, he's doing it that way. Does he have any motivation that's beyond that, beyond power? Maybe, who knows, you know?
No, that's the mystery of human beings, because it's these imperfect people are vehicles of a cosmic thing. Sometimes, look, Huey Long, you know, people in Louisiana, I think a lot of poor people like were better off with Huey Long, although he would have for sure been an American Mussolini had he become president, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, those things exist out of contrast. I mean, Hitler also did a lot of good things. You've heard this from neo-Nazis and other people, you know, making great roads. Although the Autobahn was thought about and started way before Adolf. So that's a lie.
Okay,
But he did do some stuff, and Mussolini did some stuff that we all know about. And, you know, the problem is, of course, that was totally insincere, you know. But the context was massive inflation. And a treaty in 1918 that ruined Germany for its acts in the First World War, made inflation surreal, And it's a cliche that people had a wheelbarrow. They owned a wheelbarrow so they could put the Deutschmarks in there that it took to buy a loaf of bread.
Loaf of bread, yeah.
So, and it isn't a cliche because in certain situations that I've read and been there in Germany when I was there, I've seen evidence that it was like that. It was terrible. So, boom, up pops a fascist redeemer. And they're always the same. They've got the same contours. You know, they really do. Bolsonaro in Brazil was an absolute, won't say the word, but MF of the deepest order, though I'm not separate from him. Oh, my God, it's hard. So fucking hard. Yeah. But anyway, you know, there's a guy who was absolutely putrid. One doesn't hear that word that much these days. He was just the worst thing imaginable for the Brazilian people. Mm. And yet was popular, and people sort of seemed to like him. So it's a context before the demise of democracy in each individual. Well, look at it now. Sweden and Finland, we think of them as being advanced countries, right-wing governments and leaders.
A right-wing Swede, like Bernie Sanders would be on the right wing if he lived in Sweden. You know, it's like the map of debatable issues is so different, you know. The most right wing Swedes, still they have health care for everybody. They there's no college debt. There's
there's real social nets there. That's the status quo
now. But if elitist or fascist governments continue, those are the things that they erode. So there is always a danger of those things being eroded because they've been eroded here.
It's true.
Badly. I mean, think of what happened in the Supreme Court in the last few weeks. Disastrous decisions against, you know, against people who are defenseless, basically, us, you know, and even more so African-Americans and the rest of the minorities that are trying to get some kind of placement and some kind of valency in the society. And it was just wiped out like, you know, that's what disturbs me is, and as you said, Danny, got to expand that thing. I mean, I don't understand these rationales and say, well, if we expand it then, someone else will expand it later. Fine, let's do it for now. Let's put some Merrick Garlands in there or whatever, you know. I mean,
all right, I want to go back to
end of rant there.
I'll go back to our separation issues, but you, which David, you have a couple of things that you wanted to share that I thought would be interesting.
Yeah, I wanted to look for some quotes from non-politicians.
Thank you.
And I found three of outstanding fame, if not glory, but some glory too. First one was from Nietzsche, who is often falsely designated as being the father of fascism, which is simply not true. But anyway, he made a statement which I really liked. He said, democratic institutions form a system of quarantine for tyrannical desires. In other words, he's saying that democracy really is a moment in between other worst moments. It's a quarantine pushing away those that would subjugate people for their own purposes and for their friends. And they are a time when the tyrants have to disappear. They're just not liked, loved, or anything. But those times are short. So Nietzsche was basically saying, you know, use this time. And Nietzsche was at a time when Prussia was a dominating, oppressive force in the world, sort of like the Soviet Union or Hitler's Germany.
Like what time period specifically?
I suppose it was in the 1870s. You know, Franco-Prussian War, right. The institution of all kinds of separation in Europe. And fighting between France and Germany and France and, you know, so on. So I think that what Nietzsche was sort of getting at was that we must take these democratic interludes very seriously and very passionately because they are, as he put it, a quarantine.
Short. They're short. Yeah, they're short in duration. Historically.
That seems apt for where we are in this moment.
Yeah, no, I don't know quite who he was talking about, but I know that that period in Germany was one when, the Balkanization of Germany. Germany was in many parts, and then suddenly it became a country, not just Prussia and Bavaria, but a country. And did that make it better? For a little while, probably did, until the Kaiser came and that stupid war that killed God knows how many million people between 1914 and 1918 over nothing, over the attempted assassination of a small despot. So, I mean, the 20th century, you know, as you said before, Danny, in the beginning of this, you know, it's all right for us to moan and groan about whatever we do, but is it worse now than it was in Germany in Auschwitz time? You know,
for most people, it's worse then, I think, but for an individual, it could be worse now. That's the weird thing. I agree. Climate change is a unique existential problem.
Yeah,
so is the nuclear holocaust was existential.
Yeah.
But the sort of human behavior, I still think it was worse 100 years ago. I certainly in terms of women having any power, you know, that's a global thing. But what's the other quote? You said you had two of them?
Two more, yeah.
Two more. Okay.
This one is a bit short. This one is very, I don't know. He said, I'll tell you who it is. You meet saints everywhere. They can be anywhere. There are people behaving decently in an indecent society. There are people behaving decently in an indecent society. Mm. And therein lies, as Kurt Vonnegut said, a great deal of redemption. Mm. Because as one talks and works around the world, the social contract is basically intact, except in places where it's been systematically destroyed, as in a fascist nation. And even then, you know...
Then, between small groups of people, tremendous love and oneness is possible. It's something to do with once you get into these big scales where all the categories... Yes.
Yeah. Another one is by a very famous philosopher, and his statement was, hatred is a disease... A disease in the body of freedom. Mm. And that's by Mr. Frank Sinatra.
that's so great.
You know, Frank had, you know, there have been a series
of... Frank the philosopher.
Well, there have been a series of things on I believe, Facebook recently, pinpointing Frank's individual attempts against racism, which were many.
Incredible.
Yes.
This is an example where my own opinions... changed, because I was so anti-Ronald Reagan that the fact that Sinatra was hanging around with him and there was a certain stylistic thing about it that I found offensive. And then looking objectively at the totality of what he did with his life, overwhelmingly positive, no question about it. I'm really, for me, that's an example where I've really changed my feelings about somebody. And it just remembers, like, these feelings are so ephemeral. You have some strong opinion, and then it's like, boom, you know?
Yes. Yes. Yeah. Well, Sinatra's a good example, because, I mean...
But he's a great example.
He was marvelous, along with, you know, with people, obviously with Sammy Davis Jr., but with many other people.
Yeah,
He would say to the head of the Copacabana, I'm not performing here unless Sammy gets in the front door and opens for me. And the guy would go, wait a minute, what are you talking about? You've got to... No, I have to do nothing. You know, to hell with you. That's an indecent thing you're doing.
No, he was definitely on the right side of the civil rights struggles of the 50s, no question about it. And he didn't have to be. He used his power. He also, again, it wasn't the music that most moved me, because I'm such a creature of the folk and rock and roll eras, and to me that was my parents' music. But he was a true artist. There's no getting around it. I mean, you look at that. I think there's a 4-hour documentary on him that Alex Gibney did for HBO, and it is kind of like, wow, this guy really did. He was an artist, not just a singer.
Yeah, and I mean, on that, part of his artistry and genius was in making popular music echo real conversation and phrasing. Before him, Rudy Vallee, who was the other, and Bing Crosby, to some extent, who were there, they did not do that. They had that bombastic, you know, sort of approach to words and lyrics. Sinatra just made it like he was talking at a bar to you.
There's a reason why Bob Dylan did like 3 albums emulating Sinatra, you know.
Yeah. Right. Yes.
Because there's,
I, you know, I it seems a little cute to quote him, but the quote itself is sort of interesting. Hatred is a disease in the body of freedom, which means it's anti-democratic. It's totally anti-democratic. Yeah. And the hatred that we're seeing, I was watching a piece on TV yesterday from the Secretary of State of Michigan, who's a very bright woman. I've forgotten her name, I'm sorry. But she was saying that since she spoke out against various things in the early part of the Trump, she says she just receives massive amounts of death threats and horrible things every day. And she's still the Secretary of State, and Ranford won. And her boss, Whitmer, is the same way. I see them as being heroes or heroines, whichever word you choose, because it's very frightening to get...
Michigan in general, to me, is, for those of us that are sort of, you know, liberals or progressives, whatever you want to call us, is the most encouraging situation, because that's not California or New York, you know, it's not coastal. It's a Midwestern so-called swing state where these women in particular, Gretchen Whitmer at the top of the pyramid, have created a politics that's incredibly popular in the state. I mean, they won overwhelmingly in the midterms, you know. You know, there's something about the way they communicate and the way they handle themselves that is more appealing to people than anywhere else in the country. That's a very interesting thing to study. I haven't studied it, but it's unbelievable what happened in Michigan over the last 10 or 15 years. And it is, you know, it's positive.
It must be a sense of inclusiveness that people are feeling. And that's a big reason why they get supported like that. I mean,
somehow she's able they've been able to make people that even if they had a tribal notion that Republicans or this or that it was more inclusive. Yeah, I think that's right. It's so hard. I don't envy anyone in any of these jobs. I don't envy policemen. I don't envy soldiers. I mean, these are all very tough jobs, but there's no question Michigan's been really impressive what's happened there the last half a dozen years. Yeah. Mm. And it is women. They're all of the leading. I mean, it's unbelievable. The attorney general is a woman. The governor's a woman. The secretary of state's a woman. I'm not saying all women would be that way, but in Michigan, they're all women.
Mm. Hmm. You know what His Holiness the Dalai Lama said, our future hope lies in the laps of women who raise their children in the with the kind of compassion that I was raised with. What you see in me is my mother giving me that kind of unconditional love and compassion. That will change the world, is what he says. Yeah. You know, I have another little. So there's a great Rinpoche named Soki Rinpoche is how it's supposed to be pronounced, I think.
Choki, you know,
not Choki Nima, no, Tsokni.
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 Right.
So he says, and this sort of is the arc from starting out around the quote that I read from Trungpa and Andy Carr about separation and materialism and so on. Tsokni says, I like to think about love as a multi-level phenomenon. Essence love is the foundation, the soil. From that ground, various kinds of expression love sprout and bloom in our relationships and spiritual practice. For example, we can have parental love, brotherly and sisterly love, romantic love, friendship love, devotional love, compassional love, and so forth. All of these have some texture of essence love, the moisture of essence love. Essence love is like the eyes of love, while expression love is like the body, arms, and legs. Or we could say essence love is like the capacity or underlying warmth, while expression love is the enactment, the color and shape of the flames, what you actually see. The healthy forms of expression love make life meaningful and joyful, and they are also the support that helps us survive when life is tough. These forms of love are often bound up with attachment, but that's normal. We can perhaps imagine a love beyond attachment, a deep and refined quality of unbiased love and compassion. The Beatles, the Beatles already said all of this in one of their three-minute songs, All You Need Is Love.
Yes, they did. All You Need Is Love. You know, it's very interesting because I was, that show, Our World, was the first global television show by satellite, and I was in it with my TV show in Boston.
Oh, yeah.
And we were given indicators who was going to come on the show. No one knew who was going to end the show, who was going to be the climax, you know. And then I got a phone call from London. I was in Boston saying, the Beatles, we're just letting you know that shortly after you're on, the Beatles are going to come on. What I learned last week, you know, over 50 years later, was that John Lennon wrote that song in the studio, the TV, the BBC television studio, just before the thing. He simply came into his head, he wrote it, about an hour before Our World went global, and they performed it. He told the chords, he told them the chords, and then he told them how to answer back. And the Stones were there too, and or Richards, Jagger were there, and they learned how to do the chorus. And, you know, when I did that program, I remember sitting in the studio in Boston, GBH. Not, I knew the Beatles were about to come on, but what we thought, we all thought, everybody in that room thought, they're going to do, you know, one of their huge hits. It seemed obvious. They would do Ticket to Ride or something like that. And when they did All You Need Is Love, people were crying in that control room. Very professional television directors. I wasn't because I'm English. But, you know, the rest of there were tears coming out of, particularly my assistant, Olivia, was just weeping because she felt so... she felt that it was so appropriate to this wonderful new thing called satellite television, and this being the very first thing on it or via it. So I'm just saying that because things come to people. They do. And it came to Lennon that love was the preeminent, predominant, prescient, and present undercurrent and subtext of all interconnection. And it exists whether we like it or not, it's there. Ram Dass said one time, it's there. Whether you're there or not, it's there. It's there. It exists in the air like oxygen
that's
and hydrogen.
The whole be here now.
Just so
moment.
I can understand, I mean, there's so many things about that story that are great, and thank you for that. But just so I can understand the Beatles aspect of it, I mean, that record, I mean, when they did it, I mean, what's in my mind is the record, All You Need Is Love, which is, you know, on all the Beatles' greatest hits, and that's what you can stream on Spotify and all that stuff. And that's a pretty elaborate musical arrangement with, like, horns, right?
You know? The one on our show was not like that. If you look at it...
So the original version of it was a simpler arrangement?
Yes.
Because otherwise, how could they have rehearsed all those different parts?
They couldn't. Yeah. But the way it was written in this thing that I read last week, this is, I'm recounting, I didn't know that at the time. I thought, well, you know, this, but if you look back on it, basically people were walking around the studio and they were playing the music. And I didn't see any horns or anything like that there. But when I read this last week, I was actually shocked because I thought the record came out before the show. That's how...
That's where they premiered it. Yeah,
they premiered it. But he only wrote, apparently, sorry.
The mind-blowing thing also for just Beatles nerds like me is that's in 1967. They had just put out Sgt. Pepper's. They did that like, and then they said, oh, by the way, we have another song.
Yes.
You know?
Yes. I mean, think of Let It Be and these wonderful, helpful songs. I mean, they're not just... art, you know, the Dalai Lama said he didn't much. I just read it yesterday. I'm googling things I just read. He said, "Oh, it's wonderful, but I don't waste my time with it anymore. I meditate." In other words, he actually has reached that point where he has to. His gift to us is the constant, you know, articulation of this simple word.
Yeah, yeah. No, absolutely. And I'm going to take it all fast forward to, and it's a call out for everyone to check it out. You know, David, I don't think I've mentioned this to you, Danny, but we met the artist Kesha, the pop artist, because she got into Ram Dass and she wanted to use a track, you know, that Rick Rubin produced her most recent, just a record came out a month or so ago. And so in that way, we got to know each other a little bit because she wanted something specific about what she wanted to do with the track, et cetera. And she's very substantial and artist, and the record is quite great. It's called Gag Order, so it's a shout out for that. But one of the songs, actually, I think the single, Only Love Can Save Us Now, done in a gospel chorus with a really, when we were started talking about, you know, the Beatles and what I just read around Essence Love, that it comes fast forward to, you know, to this big pop star who somehow the turn happened for her. It happened through some major suffering, and somebody gave her Be Here Now. So, is the light, that the kind of lights that we need going forward to really cut through the feeling we are separate. Absolutely. So, thank you guys for hanging out here. We haven't done it in quite some time.
Good to reconnect in the podcast plane.
Yes, conscious the plane of consciousness. Yeah, absolutely.
The pod plane.
Yeah. Yeah. By the way, Danny, if you don't know, has written a number of books that are all extremely engaging, and one of them is famous for its. Kurt Cobain being a central figure in it, but more, there's one on 1967. We were just talking about 1967. You wrote a book about 1967. So how do people even go find them? They have to
they're all on Amazon.
Amazon, yeah. Just Danny Goldberg on Amazon.
Danny Goldberg, you know, they're on Amazon. There's five of them.
They're great.
It's kind of you to mention, and hopefully I got one or two more in me, but
yeah.
For the 1967 book, you were so generous, Raghu. You got I'm sure you remember you got Ram Dass to answer seven or eight questions, and oh God, those answers were so precious to me. You know, I think I included every word of them. In the book, so you have a fingerprint on that one. That's called Insertion of the Lost Chord.
Yeah,
1967 and the hippie idea, and probably the one most pertinent to people that would listen to your network here. You know, it's not just the cultural history; it's just trying to tune into that sense of possibility for society. You know, while we're all trying to be here now inside of our own souls. You know, but anyway.
Yeah.
Great that you do this, man. Great that you keep this thing going.
Great to have you. And David, we're looking for your book, okay? Maybe people, you should write to David, and you can do it through Be Here Now Network and say, David, we want that book. How about that?
I look forward to those seven letters, and I will take them very seriously.
Meanwhile, you can go to Mind Rolling. David and I have done, of course, we've done an extraordinary amount of podcasts together over the years, but there's a couple in the last couple of years that when I'm talking about David has wonderful, wonderful stories of encounters like he just said with Alan Watts. I didn't even remember that. Maybe you've told me before.
I've been friends with David. We met in 1970. I know the year, so it's 53 years. We talk very frequently, and I still hear stories I'd never heard before. It's unbelievable.
Right.
The most interesting person I've ever met, David.
That sounds like a TV show. Oh God, yeah. So
you can't do this anymore because it's an emoji and it's so overused. But I'm doing it.
Okay,
it's real. It's like everything.
Thanks, Raghu.
Yeah,
thank you.
Thank you, guys. Thanks so much.
All right.
This is Mind Rolling on Be Here Now Network. Go to BeHereNowNetwork.com and catch so many. Alan Watts is there, for instance, along with Ram Dass and others. We shall see you next week. Thanks, guys.